On the second day of our three-day series, The Missing Pieces of Procurement Reform, we'll be focusing on people and what improvements can be made to acquisition training and the workforce. But first, we hear from Jim Williams, former acting commissioner at the General Services Administration and the top acquisition official at the IRS. Williams has lots to say about procurement, starting with the current state of government-wide acquisition vehicles.
Well, I think you also have to look at the question of the MACs, too, because all these are really multiple award contracts, GWACs being under the Clinger-Cohen Act, which allow for other agencies to use. But for the MACs, which are also multiple award contracts, I think there's not enough look across the government as a horizontal system to say, do we have the right number? On the one hand, I think for looking at the GWACs, that people like NIH and Joanne Wojtek over at NASA have done a great job. They've done a great job in terms of helping their customers get what they need. But a lot of that is on the upfront help. But if you look at the back end, which is really just the list of contractors that are available, I worry that there is too much duplication. And the duplication of taking years, as places like DHS did with Eagle 2, means that you're taking people away from doing what is actually real work, doing one of these years-long competition to get to the same people that Alliant already has or somebody else already has, means that you're just wasting those resources that are in the public sector, the government acquisition program and IT people who could be working on real task orders. Plus, it just adds a whole lot of bid and proposal costs to the industry when, in fact, if you just used a list of contractors who are already available, then that would be much more efficient. And there's too much scarce resources around right now. Missions are being hurt by not enough acquisition people. So we should not have this duplication, which simply wastes those resources. On the other hand, though, I do believe places like NASA and NIH, whether they should have been in this business in the first place or not is a question. But having said that, they've done a great job of providing competitive alternatives with better customer service. And I think GSA has stepped up to the plate with Alliant and other programs to offer that same kind of great customer service.
I mean, those contracts and those programs arise presumably because somebody feels a need is not being met. And so that seems to say that the schedules program has run its course as the primary way to buy a lot of stuff.
Well, and I think that's a great point, Tom. I don't think the schedules program has run its course, and I think schedules is still a great program, and still a lot of IT dollars goes through Schedule 70, and Kay Ely over there at GSA is a fantastic leader doing a great job on that and trying to look at how do we make our product, essentially the GSA Schedule 70, more friendly and more catering to what their customers need, and especially as people moving into as-a-service buying. And if you look back in history, NASA started as a scientific and engineering workstation procurement when literally they needed a higher powered type of PC. Well, that's no longer the case, but NASA's been in this business of providing products. The only thing I would ask is that somebody needs to have the heavy hand of managing this managed competition, and all of these GWACs, like a general shared services, should play according to the same rules. There should not be subsidized fees, so that if GSA is full cost recovery, they should not have to compete with somebody who is being subsidized by appropriations. So it should be a level playing field. So NASA SEWP was created for a different reason. It has continued because it's a good vehicle. But on the other hand, I think everything that you have under NASA SEWP, you could do under Schedule 70.
It's interesting, though, that the agencies tend to favor one or the other, because NASA SEWP 5 just came out. And according to Ms. Wojtek, who is the program manager there that you mentioned, it's the Defense Department and VA are the biggest users there. And because VA wanted more health-related services and products, they are now on SEWP 5, which would seem to make it more competitive with NITAC's, the CIOSP and ECS ones operated by NIH. So you've got a little bit of almost direct competition for the same dollars.
Well, I think you're right, and I think Joanne, again, has done a great job over there. But again, you know, looking at NASA doing things in the health field, I'm not sure that's the right thing. But there is not been anybody strong at OMB who has actually done anything proactively about this from what I've seen in the last few years.
Because when Dan Gordon was the administrator of the federal procurement shop at the White House, he did impose the requirement for a business case much more rigorously on the GWACs. And it looks as if the recent ones have followed that.
Well, I think they've developed a business case, but I guess I would like to see if you developed a business case and you had to post that business case where somebody would have to say, well, I don't agree or I don't think you should do this. Has there ever been one where either for a GWAC or a MAC where somebody has posted a business case and then it's not been done? So is it just been, I mean, Dan did the right thing, but is it just a paperwork exercise? And again, there's nobody from the top down looking at the overall efficiency of the system.
We're speaking with Jim Williams, a partner in Chambak and Williams Consulting and a longtime federal executive in a lot of agencies and a lot of functions. And what about the ability or the efficacy of these vehicles that we've been talking about, MACs and GWACs, to fulfill big agency missions in contrast to using the classic systems integrator contract? Are they effective there in terms of offering a task order basis instead of a gigantic grand design contract approach for accomplishing something big?
Well, I think you can, when you have a need for that system integrator, large-scale systems integrator, which I don't look at them as a negative as other people do. You know, as long as the government has the ability to manage an integrator, I think using an integrator can be the right thing to do. But I think whether you use a GWAC or you use an individual full and open ending up with a single award, either way, I think when you have that kind of need, you end up with a single award. And most of these GWACs have a multi-billion dollar ceiling anyway. You know, the question will be, how long should that relationship with that system integrator be? You know, IRS, we were looking at 10 years because that's how long the program would take to accomplish all the changes. I think you can do either one. You really have to look at what's the duration you need that single contractor for, and is the vehicle the right vehicle to accomplish what you want?
Now, back in those days, the tax systems modernization took some while and took a couple of tries to get going to where it started regularly throwing off improvements and milestones that were tangible for IRS, and I guess it still is. But so does that say that the procurement system was the problem or early on, or was it simply the way people applied the tools that were already available?
Well, let me say that was a very, very tough challenge. Having worked inside that, you're talking about like changing the taxpayer database, which was developed during the Kennedy administration, and it was maybe 50 or 60 million lines of code. And to change that into a relational database is a monumental challenge. And so I don't really want to fault anybody in that. Did they have some missteps? I think there were some. I don't think it was a problem with the procurement process. I think it, on one hand, maybe the first few tries, IRS did not have the understanding, as many civilian agencies didn't, what it took to really manage a large-scale program like that. And in fact, through ACT-IAC and you know, Dan Chenick and Stan Salo and I have been working on something for years about how to manage one of these large-scale programs, and we actually came up with something called the 7S for Success Framework, which we gave to Steve Van Roekel. How do you manage these large programs with the right governance, stakeholder management? They are tough because what you're talking about is a whole lot of interconnected systems, interconnected legacy organizations, and trying to get them all moving in lockstep towards that new system is a tough thing to do.
So you have lived and worked under the Brooks Act, and then you lived and worked under the successor to that, the Clinger-Cohen Act, which is still basically the extant legislation, although there have been a lot of modifications since then. Are things better now than they were at the dawn of Clinger-Cohen, and are they better than they were under the Brooks Act? I guess I'm asking, is more procurement reform needed, in your opinion?
Well, the Brooks Act had that thing where you had to go to GSA for a delegation of procurement authority, and having been at an agency that went to GSA at the time, I thought that was a total waste of time. So I think eliminating that part of the Brooks Act was the right thing to do. I think things that have been put in place since Clinger-Cohen, paying more attention to things like the portfolio stat and looking at rationalizing the technology investments, I think all of those have been very good things. And I think, you know, looking at IT is such a critical mission enabler, because there's not a government agency in town that doesn't depend, or an organization anywhere these days that doesn't depend upon IT as a critical mission function. And I do think, you know, there's more that can be done. Whether legislation is needed, I'm not sure, but getting acquisition, IT, and program people working better together, partnering better with industry. One area where I think we've gone backwards is in the open communications with industry. For some reason, whether it's the oversight environment, whatever, a lot of the acquisition people we're raising these days are so risk averse, they believe it's better never to talk to industry. And if you look at the private sector, I always draw a graph that as you go over time in an acquisition, the private sector increases the communications with industry because they want to line up what's possible in the industry with what their needs are. In the government, we tend to shut down that as time goes on, and that's a mistake.
Yeah, the Mythbusters campaign was aimed at some of that, not so much after solicitations were underway, but just getting to know what's out there before there's a solicitation or a formal request for bids. You don't see it happening that much.
I think it's actually gotten worse, and I applaud Dan Gordon for the Mythbusters in trying to change that. I often ask people, young acquisition professionals, when does the blackout period start in federal procurement? And I get all sorts of answers. You know, when market research starts, when we issue the RFI, when we issue the RP, when proposals come in. And I was telling them the correct answer is it doesn't exist. There's no such thing that tells you you should shut down communications. And people, you know, will not communicate because they're afraid of a protest. Well, you know, what we always did was we would communicate and really treat people as they wanted to be treated, to communicate with them throughout the process, to tell them, here's what we're going to do, here's what we said we're going to do, and by the way, we did what we said we're going to do. We treated you fairly, and we made a rational business decision for the government. And I think if you do that with industry, more often than not, they will go away because they know, one, they've been treated fairly, and two, that you have a very powerful defense if they decide to take you on. And I think that we need to go back to where, you know, after the National Performance Review, we looked at people, procurement people, as those business judgment people that help get the mission done. And I don't think whether you're an IT or an acquisition person, you should look at your job as a mission unto itself. It is, but it's ultimately to support the mission of the government.
So when it comes to looking at a contractor or a set of contractors to try to understand what the latest capabilities are and technologies, who should do that in an agency? Contracting officer, program manager, all of the above?
All of the above. And I don't think that there's a time when you should say, okay, we don't need to hear anything from industry. We know everything. Because things, as you know, Tom, in IT, they're changing rapidly. And the government talks about innovation. On one hand, they talk about innovation. But on the other hand, they shut down communications. They go to the lowest price technically acceptable when they shouldn't. Now, it's a good tool for some things, but it's being used for too many things because they think it's safe. They actually cite declining budgets for why we should use lowest price technically acceptable, which really should have no correlation, but yet they do it anyway. And so I really worry that we are actually hurting our ability to not only meet the mission, but to draw in suppliers to the government, to get innovation from the suppliers. And frankly, we're making the people who do these jobs feel like they're back to just being people who say no and paper pushers. And that's not where we want these people to be.